This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Hi, everybody. I'm Dr. David Granite, and welcome to Health Matters. Sometimes we talk about surgery. Sometimes we talk about disease. Today, we're going to go a little bit differently on a topic, though, that may be even more important, because it affects every one of us. One way or another, we all end up in a vehicle, and one way or another, we can all be touched by someone who makes a bad decision to get behind the wheel when it's inappropriate. But when is it inappropriate? When is it wrong to get behind the wheel and take control of a two-ton vehicle? When you've had too much to drink? Well, then what is too much to drink? We need some answers. And to do that, we have the world's expert with us, Dr. David Phillips. Welcome.
Thank you.
My mother would say you're a real doctor, you know, a PhD. He's a professor of sociology who is now an emeritus professor, but only just recently. Your background is impeccable with the best universities, a storied career, but not in medicine, in sociology and epidemiology. And what we're going to talk about today is the work that you've done in trying to figure out of where do we draw the line in how someone's impacted by alcohol and getting behind the wheel? So, you know, recently you've had some new work come out, but you've been looking at this for a while now. And why don't you tell us a little bit about what you've been doing and how you've been doing it?
Well, I should say, first of all, that the reason I publish in medical journals is because both my parents were physicians. They never really believed that I published until I published in Science and the New England Journal of Medicine and Lancet. Of course, I claim this means nothing, right?
But, yes.
Right. So another reason I do research on epidemiological topics is that the data are so fantastically good. I think the society collects information on things we're scared of. So you get very good data on death, for example. In this particular study, we used a data set called FARS, Fatal Analysis Reporting System, collected by the feds on all fatal motor vehicle crashes in the entire country. So it's wonderful data. Anyone can get at it. It's free. It's electronically accessible. And that's what we used. I co-authored with two undergraduate students to produce this paper.
Well, which is, it's to go off beat for a second here. The idea that undergraduate students can make an impact is very exciting, I think, for a college student.
Right.
And as a professor at a university, you have these enthusiastic, passionate students who have lots of energy that you can help direct that passion. It must be very rewarding for both them and you.
Yeah, it's wonderful. My brother says the mark of a good relationship is when each person in the group thinks he's getting the best of the deal.
Yes.
So I think I'm getting the best, and the students think they're getting the best. It's really an extremely invigorating arrangement.
So, you know, we're talking about getting behind the wheel, having had something to drink. And I alluded earlier on that this affects more people than most diseases do.
Right, for sure.
What kind of data are we looking at in terms of how many people are affected each year by alcohol-related vehicle accidents and deaths?
In the FARS database, there are maybe 100,000 crashes in that database per year. And I think that driver alcohol is probably the main or one of the very most important factors influencing this. I don't offhand know what fraction of these crashes are alcohol involved, but it's a big fraction.
And I'm picturing somebody says, well, I don't drink and drive.
Yeah.
But they're on the road with people who do.
Right. It's a worrisome thing because you can be hit by somebody else. You can be a pedestrian or a cyclist hit by someone else. You can be a passenger who is accompanying someone who's got a little bit of alcohol in him. And the heavyweight problem in this society is that people tend to think of the situation as a sort of a light switch on or off. You're either drunk or you're not drunk.
Well, we know that, right? Because 0.8
right.
has been set as the as that
right.
spot where
right.
just under that you're okay,
right.
over that you're
That's
not.
Right.
I can't think of anything in medicine
right.
that has
exactly.
such a threshold cutoff.
Right, nothing is black and white like that, exactly. And in the lab, hundreds of experiments have shown that even if you have the tiniest amount of alcohol in you, you do worse at various tasks, including driving.
I can't imagine. I'm just thinking about as you speak. I can't imagine a surgeon.
Right.
Oh, walking
there you go.
To the operating room,
right.
Having had a little bit to drink, and
right.
Everybody thinking that's okay.
Right, that's right.
But yet, getting behind a two-ton vehicle to drive.
Right. People don't realize how much energy is involved in a two-ton vehicle that's going 60 miles an hour, far more than a bullet.
And if it gets out of control, it's bad.
Right, you have the capacity to hurt not only yourself, but lots of other people, too.
So can we start with, where did 0.8 come from?
It's somewhat arbitrary, this 0.08%. It used to be in some states 0.10%, in other states 0.08%. Relatively recently, the feds required, they bribed all the states to go down to 0.08. But most of Europe, almost all of Europe, has a blood alcohol legal limit of 0.05. And some countries in Europe, like Sweden, have yet much lower levels. Sweden and Japan have levels of 0.02 and 0.03. And I think, based on our data, that is what you would actually decide to do if you were just going to look at the data.
So let's talk about what you found.
Yeah.
You're looking at these accidents, and then you start saying, what was the level of alcohol in people's blood involved?
Right.
What'd you find?
What you find is consistent with what they find in the lab, but people didn't know that this worked in the real world also. FARS, this data set I was talking about, records blood alcohol level in 0.01% increments. And you can see that the chance of being officially blamed for a crash goes up smoothly from 0.01 to 0.02 to 0.03 to 0.04, all the way up to 0.24.
So it's not a threshold effect.
No, there's no threshold effect at 0.08, as you might expect from the law. It's just a smooth. And in fact, there isn't a detectable difference, really, between what's happening just under 0.08 and at 0.08.
Does it sort of current level out?
Or? Yes, it goes up like this from 0.01 to 0.24, and then it's level. So above 0.24, no matter how drunk you are.
You're drunk, right.
Right.
But there's some level at which you're impaired. And impairment is impairment, and you shouldn't be behind the wheel.
Right, right. We found that even at the minimal, the lowest possible blood alcohol level of 0.01, you're 46% more likely to be blamed for a crash than is the sober person you crash into. So if I have the 0.01% in me and you're sober and we crash, I'm 46% more likely to be blamed than you are. And that's based on hundreds of thousands of cases, yeah.
Can you give us a sense of what 0.01 is in terms of how much alcohol you've had?
One or two cans of beer.
I mean, there are a lot of people who drive having one or two cans of beer.
Yeah, yeah, right.
And they would absolutely put their hand up and say, I'm safe.
Right.
Maybe, I don't know what your data set says,
right,
doctor,
right.
But I'm safe.
I once heard a California Highway Patrolman give the following evidence that would appeal to people who would say that they're safe. He says he invites people over to his house to play darts, and he gives half of them beer and the other half not beer. Then he looks at the scores of the people with the beer and the people without the beer. In my case, I had learned this because I had a neighbor across the street who used to play pool with him, and I was somewhat better than he was, slightly better pool player. And then he started saying, Dave, wouldn't you like a half glass of beer? And then when I had a half glass of beer, I was consistently worse than him. So that'll do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I mean, something as small as that.
Right.
Obviously, a question is going to come up somewhere along the line is, if I've had something to drink, how long do I need to wait before I can drive? And how do I know what my blood alcohol level is, whether I've gotten down to a level where it's okay? If I had a drink at 5 o'clock and it's 9 o'clock, can I drive?
Yeah. Well, the California Highway Patrol website has a chart which gives information on this, but they unfortunately combine they have the range 0.01 to 0.04 all in one clump, so you can't see what's going on in tiny increments. But what we can see is that no matter how you parse it, people with 0.01% are significantly much more often blamed for the crash than people who are sober. And in an earlier paper we did in addiction, we showed that not only are these minimally buzzed people are more likely to be blamed for the crash, but they cause more dangerous crashes. More people are killed in that kind of crash.
So they're more severe crashes.
More severe crashes.
Is there an age effect? For example, a 0.01 in an 18-year-old versus 0.01 in a 50-year-old? Or does it not matter?
I don't know the answer to that. I do know that, I mean, I could find out quickly, but I don't know the answer offhand. I do know that in California, that's one of the few circumstances where they do pay attention to 0.01%. If you're under 21 and you have 0.01% alcohol in you and you're caught, then you're punished by having your license taken away for a year. And what we're saying in this paper is it would be good to generalize that beyond the minors and start applying this kind of rule to people over 21 as well.
Now, there's public perception. And then there's science.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's public policy.
Yes.
So how do you get science to be the guiding force and cool-headed logic
right.
for public policy?
Yeah, it's a heavyweight problem. That's not my area of expertise, right? My area of expertise is basically epidemiological research, not public policy. I don't know how you get people to say the most important thing to pay attention to, or maybe the only thing to pay attention to is how many people are being hurt or how many people are being blamed. I don't know how you would do that. I think the most we can probably expect from research like mine, we seem to be the first to do this, but we hope that there will be other research like this too. The most you can expect, I think, is that there will be increased pressure to reduce the level from BAC, blood alcohol content of 0.08, down below that maybe to 0.05 like most of Europe, or 0.03 or 0.02 like Sweden or Japan.
Do you think there'll be pushback?
Yes. When I had my previous paper in addiction on dangerousness of crashes, there was pushback from the Beverage Council of America. What a surprise.
yes.
and we said, which, and by the way, that paper was also co-authored with undergraduates. We said, look, we're not saying don't drink. We're just saying don't drink and drive. And in Sweden, what happens is all the taxi cabs line up outside the bar and take these guys home. Then that would be fine.
Yeah. I grew up in New York, as we talked about before the show, and you can drink and get into a taxi or a train or a bus.
Right.
Or you can walk home.
Right.
But we live in Southern California, you and I, right now.
Right.
Their cars are sacrosanct in some ways.
Right.
Somebody goes out to dinner, has a few drinks with their friends. They want to drive home.
Right.
How do you get this information so that it permeates, even if it doesn't change public policy? How do we change public behavior?
Right. Well, I think one thing to be aware of is to say to yourself, okay, I'm buzzed. I shouldn't drive. Okay, this guy is buzzed. I'm not going to travel with him. It may be that it'll be easier for people to shy away from being passengers in the short run. And the guy says, oh, yeah, you don't want to come with me? May make him feel bad. I don't know. I don't know how you. I mean, advertising is not my area either. So one of the nice things about the kind of epidemiological research I do is that I provide data for the debate, but I'm not really skilled at, and nor am I interested in actually joining the debate. I'd like it to come out so that the BAC level is reduced, maybe to zero, but that's not my bailiwick, and I love doing the preliminary stuff.
Yeah, but it seems so intuitively obvious that if the BAC level is lowered, that we're looking at lives saved.
Right.
And not only lives and individual impact saved, but to be somewhat mercenary about it, money saved.
Oh, yeah.
For society as
right,
well.
Right, right. Huge amounts of, the cost of injuries and such like from alcohol is just enormous. It just people take it for granted because there's alcohol all around.
There's been people who have suggested that cars should come with their own alcohol testers, that you can't start the car unless you blow into a tube and prove that you are not intoxicated. There are so many different ways that public policy can change based upon the data that you have.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that's not your bailiwick, but it's that data is, without that, public policy will never change.
Right, that's right.
And so I wanted to make sure that you and I had a chance to talk about the value of epidemiologic studies.
Yeah, wonderful.
And so if you could just touch base upon why it's so powerful how it's so powerful.
Sure. Well, there's this wonderful, wonderful study, 1851, Snow on Cholera. Beautiful study. Nobody knew what caused cholera. Snow found out, he did a lot of different pieces to the study, but he found out that people who were drinking water from this water supply company had a much higher cholera rate than people who were drinking water from that water supply company. In those days in London, water supply companies competed with each other to supply water. And he went and looked to see where the water came from for the Southwark and Vauxhall Water Company, which was the one that was associated with lots of cholera, and the Lambeth Company, which had very little cholera. Lambeth Company was getting their water from the Thames upstream from London. Southwark and Vauxhall was getting their water 10 feet downstream from a sewage outlet pipe. Nobody knew that this was a bad thing. After Snow did this study, people all over Europe and the United States all of a sudden started saying, let's clean up the water supply. They didn't know anything about bacteria causing illness. This is 1851. And still, he was saving lives by doing this preliminary epidemiological stuff. The stuff on cigarette smoking and cancer is the same kind of deal. You find very beautiful evidence ahead of time before you know what the mechanism is, before you do the lab studies, and then you can get people to live longer just on the basis of the epidemiological studies. Lind on scurvy would be another example. This is Lind in 1750 discovers that if people eat these and these kinds of foods, they're less likely to get scurvy than those and those kinds of foods. And 1750, nobody knew about vitamins. And look at the lives that this guy saved. Look at the difference that he made.
Well, in many ways, these are the actual greatest advances in medicine for public health. Proper sanitation.
Right.
Hand washing.
Right, right.
And those were all really epidemiologic public health type of approaches.
Right, right. Semmelweis discovering that if the physician washed his hands, he'd be less likely to have patients who were infected. I mean, right, it's just wonderful stuff, but it is only preliminary stuff. The next step is the lab work, and the next step is up to not the epidemiologist, but people who do different kind of work.
And do you feel a little bit like a detective when you're doing this?
It is wonderful. And actually, when I taught my epidemiology class, I would ask the students to tell me, in what ways is the epidemiologist like a detective? And in what ways is the epidemiologist not like a detective? And I point out to them that Sherlock Holmes, the guy who wrote Sherlock Holmes, Arthur Conan Doyle, was a physician, and he modeled Sherlock Holmes on a physician that he knew, was very good at working out these very subtle details.
In public parlance, they often confuse coincident events or numbers that happen to be happening at the same time as causal. I know that when I went to med school, the epidemiology course that I took, they showed that the number of Mercedes in a country correlated with heart disease.
Ah, yes.
But very clearly that it wasn't causal.
Right, right.
How do you separate out? I mean, here you are. You've shown that blood alcohol level changes and the car accidents increase or their blame for it increases. How do you know it's causal? I mean, when you're looking at this kind of data, how do you put those two together?
Yes. Well, one of the tests for causality is to see if, supposing I think that X causes Y, like in this case that alcohol in you, it makes you more likely to be blamed for an accident. One of the tests for causality is it true that the more of X, the more of Y? Is it true that the more of the alcohol, the more the crashes? And that turns out to be the case. Another test for causality is to say, if I hold constant a huge number of other variables, does this finding still persist? And in our case, we had a beautiful natural experiment, really beautiful natural experiment, in which we had two people crashing together, and one was sober and one was minimally buzzed. Now, when they crash together, you're controlling on an enormous number of variables because they're crashing together at exactly the same time, exactly the same place. So let's say you and I crash, God forbid, you and I crash, and the crash takes place in Boston, December 25th, outside a bar,
It's the same weather for both of us.
Everything is the same. Lighting, everything is the same, right. Except that I've got the alcohol in me and you don't. So that's another way in which we are reassuring ourselves that what's going on is the causal path. In the actual paper, I can't talk about this, but in the actual paper, we investigate and test four alternative explanations for the findings also. Anyone who's interested can download this.
But you're able to show that those are unlikely.
Yes, that's right. And that's another thing you do. You can never prove a hypothesis. All you can do is say, up till now, I've been unable to disprove it. And all the competing hypotheses have been disproved. No one has been able to think of any competing hypotheses.
Well, I wanted you to talk about this because I can just imagine that as something that a smokescreen that counterargument would be. Yeah, it's just a random accidental event that he found and that these are not connected.
Yeah, well, that's actually another alternative explanation which you routinely have to examine, that the results are just due to random fluctuation in the data. And that's why you have tests of statistical significance and margin of error. And that's why also you look at enormous numbers of cases. So we looked at more than 500,000 cases. And you can see that year after year after year, the same pattern shows up. So that's another thing that makes you less willing to believe that what you've got is just a fluke.
I'm smiling because it's an ad hoc discussion of the value of science.
Right. That's true.
And although the paper is important for what it's talking about, it's also an important lesson and reminder.
Right.
Of how we get information.
Right.
And how experts know what they're talking about.
Yeah. And I would say in our case also, it's a wonderful demonstration of the importance of the natural experiment as a way of controlling for
Explain the natural experiment again, because I want to make sure everybody understands
what
you
mean. Yeah, so, well, I'll give you an example first from Snow and then from what we did. So Snow was wondering if the Southwark and Vauxhall people who died with abnormally high rates from cholera had something else different about them from the Lambeth people who died from very low rates. Now, most of London, the Southwark and Vauxhall people were getting only the Southwark and Vauxhall water. Most of London, the Lambeth people were getting only the Lambeth water. But there was one region of London where the pipes for the two companies went down the same street, and some people got this water and some people got that water. And he said, you couldn't think of a better natural experiment. Hundreds of thousands of people in the same circumstances, some supplied with this water, some supplied with that water, many cases not knowing which water they were getting, and the Southwark and Vauxhall people had the high rates and the Lambeth people had the low rates. So that's an example of a natural experiment. It's a really beautiful example of a natural experiment. And the example we had was if you and I crash or if hundreds of thousands of us crash, then you're standardizing on really literally billions of different variables, billions, because there's 1,440 minutes in the day, you're standardizing on that. There's 365 days in the year, you're standardizing on that. There's this and this holiday or that and that holiday, you're standardizing on that.
Temperature.
Everything. Right. So that's a natural experiment also. And we corrected for other variables by other methods, but the natural experiment is such a beautiful way to do it.
And so you've had there are lab experiments that have demonstrated this impairment that takes place at low levels of blood alcohol
right.
level. And now you have this natural experiment that we could never do. I mean,
right.
you can't really
That's
do
right.
this. It all is lining up in truly an incontrovertible way.
Yeah, I encountered in a detective story the other day a beautiful word, consilience. And what consilience means is the convergence of evidence. So that's what you've got here. You've got the lab stuff showing it. You've got the natural experiment showing it in the real world. And it's all pointing towards the same thing. So that's very reassuring.
In the few minutes that we have left, what would you like to see happen now? Where do you go from here in terms of investigating?
Rebecca and I, she's one of the co-authors, we're continuing to study this wonderful data set, this FARS data set. And I recommend it to other people, too. It's free. Enormous. It's electronically readable. So we can't talk about what we're doing on that because we don't want to be scooped. What I'm hoping is that I'm hoping that individuals will be affected by this so that they won't drive or that they won't accompany someone who is buzzed. I'm hoping that lawyers will be affected by this so that if they have a case where one person in the crash is sober and one person is 0.02%, they'll pay attention to data like ours. I'm hoping that police will be affected by this. I'm hoping that insurance companies will be affected by this. I'm hoping that policymakers will be affected by this. As you said, almost everyone gets in a car sometime. So this is something that affects an enormous number of us. And who knows if this is going to happen in my lifetime, but I'm hoping it will.
Well, you're making a difference. And
yeah.
In my office, I affect retail, one patient at a time.
Yes.
What you're doing is affecting wholesale.
Yes.
The entire population of the world.
Yeah, actually, right. I had done research earlier. My students and I were the first to show that heavily publicized suicides stories trigger additional suicides. And now, all over the United States, they no longer carry suicide stories unless the person would be on the front page regardless of how he died. So that's an example of epidemiology making a difference. And yeah. I'd like this to be another example.
Well, thank you so much for your efforts. Thank you for taking the time to sit with us and chat today.
Yeah, my pleasure. Big time.
It's been wonderful.
Yeah, yeah.
We've been listening to Dr. David Phillips talking about the value in general of epidemiology and how we know the information that we're talking about is really very correct. In specific, we were talking about blood alcohol level. And I think if you were listening closely, you heard this. Don't drink and drive. There is no level of blood alcohol that is okay. There is no level of blood alcohol that is okay. So if you remember that, don't get behind the wheel of a car and take that 1-ton or 2-ton vehicle for a ride when you are somewhat impaired. I'm a surgeon. If I did that, it would be malpractice. And it should be malpractice to get behind the wheel of a car the same way. Remember, knowledge is power. I'm Dr. David Granite, and this has been Health Matters.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.